Well, it's great to be back here again, although this time I can only stay for a short time. And thanks to Richard and to Boris for inviting me. Okay, so my audience is the students. I apologize for those of you that we've been running into a lot the last half a year, I think. Poor Richard's been in my talk for four times in the last half a year. I'm still in Switzerland on a sabbatical. That's what it is. A lot of Europeans.
I invited you twice.
Well, thank you. But I hope you find something to do during this time. I'm sort of going to tell about the work in our lab for the last 4 or 5 years, sort of the mainstream or simplified version. And feel free to ask questions of students and also senior faculties. I guess that invitation is not needed. Okay, so I'm going to talk about bacterial growth and metabolism, and the first question would be why even talk about this in a program on evolution of drug resistance? All right, the big part of the topic is on bacteria evolution, and it so happened that growth is a commonly used measure of fitness. Why is my thing not working? Okay, right. And a lot of what bacteria do is metabolism. They are biochemical experts, okay? And so a lot of the experiments one tend to play with have something to do with metabolism. So if you want to try to make a link between genotype, phenotype, and fitness, well, one should know something about what's going on inside of the body. Okay. It's still not working. Okay, so for all of my talk, I'll be talking about batch culture exponential growth. Okay, so what that is you take a flask, a test tube, and inoculate a little bit of bacteria in there, watch it grow until it's exponential. Okay, so actually you do this several times so that from the beginning of the experiment it is growing exponentially. Okay, and everything I'll be talking about is around here before it reaches the stationary state. Okay, and the efforts are done to make it as exponential as possible, so it's clear what we're talking about. Right. Okay, so lambda is the growth rate. So it was recognized by Monod a long time ago that you can learn a lot just by doing exponential growth. Okay. And so he's a very forward-looking person. Despite the immense complexity of the phenomena, so bacterial growth generally obeys relatively simple laws make it possible to define certain quantitative characteristics of the growth cycles. Okay? And by exponential laws, he doesn't mean, quantitative laws, doesn't mean just this. Right? This is just exponential growth defines one number, growth rate. Okay, and then you measure other stuff and relate to that. So the so here's an example. It's called the Monod's law, Monod's monokinetics. Right. So for E. coli grown on lactose, it changes the concentration of the lactose and observe the growth rate, and you get some kind of a reasonable description by a Michaelis curve. Okay, so this is what biochemists are used to describing the properties of enzymes, but here is a whole cell, okay, complicated with all its components, right? For a cell to double, everything's got to work. Okay, yet, just looking at this, there's a chance that something may be described by mathematics, okay, and that's amazing, right? Stan Leibler was at ETH where I have been just 2 months ago. He made a seminar called Unreasonable Ineffectiveness of Mathematics in Biology. So that's obviously a play of the Eugene Wigner's article on the unreasonable effectiveness of the mathematics in physical sciences. Okay. So this is something many of us get into biology. If you work with an experimental system, feel powerless. Okay. just what to do mathematically. And so through this talk, I will try to show you our attempts at the little things they can do. And so most of the talk will just be linear relations. And so nowadays, we actually advanced to the stage where we can actually write down ordinary differential equation and describe some time course curves. Okay, so let me start by summarizing the sort of known the growth law that's known for 50 years. Okay. So people grow E. coli and its cousins. Okay. And so every one of these points is an exponential growth in a some growth medium that supports the growth rate. And then they measure the total RNA of the cell, total protein of the cell, and take the ratio. And you see a nice linear behavior for different strains. Okay, so empirically similar to this relation. And so what does this mean? RNA is a proxy for the ribosomes. Most of the RNA in the cells, so stable RNAs, ribosome RNAs, T RNAs, and such. And total protein is a proxy for how big the cell is, the cell volume. The density of E. coli does not change when you change the growth rate, unless you change the osmolarity. Okay, so we're keeping osmolarity constant. So this ratio is telling you about ribosome concentration. Right, so why should ribosome concentration have a linear dependence with growth rate? So Ole Moeller, whose lab first discovered this relation, had a simple understanding of it. I would like to describe to you. So assume that ribosomes are efficiently engaged in protein synthesis. All of the ribosomes are busily working. Okay. So then if the proteins are stable, which is a good approximation for fast-growing cells like E. coli, then the rate of a mass accumulation is just the rate of how fast ribosome works. Okay, so in exponential growth, that's just a growth rate multiplied by the total mass, and the rate of how fast ribosome works is just the number of ribosome times how fast the ribosome works. Okay, number of ribosomes versus the mass of ribosome, and you set those two together, then you see yes, a linear relation is expected if this translation rate does not change with this growth rate. Okay, and if you look at the data, okay, so you see obviously there is a offset already, but one can make various excuses for what this offset might come from. So obviously in this model, Moeller assumes that all of the ribosomes are engaged in translation, but this cannot be literally the case. There needs to be a free pool of ribosome that's ready to jump in, right? So that might be one of the excuses, and the other possible thing you can think of. But if you look at the slope of this, and you can convert everything to absolute units. We're talking about quantitative biology here. Numbers what we can use as a clutch to determine whether we're on the right track, right? And the number seems to correspond to the known the order of the known amino acid translation. Okay, but then the first question is, could this be a coincidence? Okay, so this is something I find in my experience as a physicist going to biology. It is very to do something and get some result that you expect. Okay, and but accidents you can have in biology can have 5 points lining on the straight lines and for 5 different reasons.
Okay.
Wait,
you
only
four reasons.
You have four reasons. All right, and so now if you're doing experiment to show you're right, then you can conveniently cite that. But then often the reason biology is displaying whatever it's displaying is more interesting than what we might think. Okay, so it pays to question and then try to get a bottom of things. So this could be one of the coincidences, and so we did the experimental test how much this line has to do with this explanation. So if you want to do experiment and say, well, if Moeller is right, then if I change this translation rate, then I should still have straight line relation, but with different slopes. Yeah. So this experiment was done actually by a postdoc who was an applied mathematician who had never done microbiology before. We went to the lab and learned to do the experiment. So you see that the there's still linear relation, and the slope changes in a way that's expected. So for different, these are, each of these is a translational mutant where the ribosome has some has a defect, and the translation rate has been measured, and the one over slope of this corresponds well to the translation rate. Okay, and moreover, this offset doesn't seem to have any systematic dependence. All right, so then we'll take this as an empirical starting point. So actually, what's at the bottom of this is very complicated, but phenomenologically, and we established the slope has something to do with translation. Okay, and that's it's based on the experiments. So then, if we go back to Moller's picture, then his major assumption is ribosomes are efficiently engaging translation, right? And so if we have checked this, then basically that's the message, right? If this picture is correct, then the meaning is that ribosomes, most of the ribosomes are efficiently engaged. That has a huge consequence, right? And everything we're going to talk about is just based on the consequence of this, okay? So if all of the, so ribosomes are the only ones that's making proteins. If all of them are engaged, you cannot arbitrarily, you know, dial up and down protein levels as you wish. Okay, so you express some genes, spit out some mRNAs, it's necessarily going to increase the protein level, because in order to increase the protein level of something, the ribosome have to work on these mRNAs, express these proteins, and these ribosomes need to be taken off out of something else. So there's a global coupling. Okay. So everything I'll talk about is about this global coupling. Okay, that now these days we have lots of sort of omics data that tells you transcriptomics and the proteomics, transcript level and proteome level. There's not a good correlation. There are many studies, and none of them find good correlation. Okay, and this in light of this is not surprising. Okay. So based on this constraint, we made a simple model of cell growth. Okay, so this is in this very coarse grain view of a metabolism. We have the cell will have some nutrients coming in, and there's some proteins and some enzymes that convert these nutrients to a pool of amino acid, and then the ribosome consumes the amino acid, makes the proteins. Okay, so there's some numbers here. So it involves protein and it involves rates. So think about the proteome of the cell, the total abundance of the proteins. Think of it as a pie. Then some component of it is devoted to this translation. Okay, and we know, okay, so there's some component that's fixed. So that was determined by some other experiments that would not have time to describe. Okay, so this is just entitlement. No matter how fast you're growing, you have to pay to make these proteins. Then there are these proteins that's responsible for translation, and they're related to growth rate in a linear way.
And the number of proteins per, the density of the protein effectively?
So everything is measured per total protein, but I told you at the very beginning, per total protein scales with the cytoplasmic volume. So per total protein means is a proportion of the density. Okay, and for very few organisms can make such a statement. Okay, so for E. coli, it's so well characterized that it actually knows the volume, knows the cytoplasmic volume.
Right. Now I guess I'm wondering about, because the Q is really a fixed number rather than a fixed...
Fraction. A fraction, so about 50%, we determine about 50% of the proteome, okay, so this protein per total protein do not change with growth rate. The other 50% are adjustable. Okay. And they do not have to be different proteins. A protein could have a component here, a component there. All right, so the role of this protein, this translational protein growth, we just established this linear relation that the Moller told us about. And we propose in parallel that there should also be a component of the metabolic proteins, okay, that's needed to convert this nutrient to amino acid. And we propose also a linear relation, okay. And the coefficients basically tells you how good the nutrient is. So that is how efficient the enzymes devoted to taking in these nutrients are. So then together with the constraint that these two components add up to a constant, then we have three equations and three variables, growth rate and these two fractions. So then, in this picture, when you give the cells a nutrient, okay, then you fix this coefficient mu, and the cell then has to adjust, partition these different fractions so that all these three equations are satisfied. Okay, how can a cell figure out how to solve three linear equations simultaneously? Well, there's a lot behind it. That has to do with the molecular mechanism. If you're interested, we can spend an hour talking about that. Okay. But there's basically various feedback feedforward system so that this can be done in a sort of automated way. Okay. I just give you an analogy to hang on to. We have three linear relations, which is basically it's a very simple system with two resistors in series, right? So you think about growth rate as a flux or the current going through the resistors. Okay, think about this protein fraction, the proteins devoted to carry out each of these tasks as a voltage, right? Then these linear relations are just Ohm's laws with these coefficients being the conductance of the material. Okay, they're state variables of the systems. And then this is the voltage summations, okay? So then you can express, for this simple electrical circuit, you can express growth rate in terms of the fixed variable by eliminating these voltages. Okay, so that is, so the resistance add for a serial circuit, right, so that's inverse of the conductance add. So there's a simple relation of a growth rate just in terms of the state variables of the system. Okay. Now, it is interesting to rewrite this relation in this way, okay? So this is a very interesting relation, right? It is, the nu has to do with nutrient. So this is a Michaelis relation.
So nu is some linear combination of the nutrient.
Nu is basically, if you write down, all of this in the spirit of phenomenology. If you want to write down a molecular model to interpret it, then nu will be, say, the catalytic, the k-cat of N less enzyme that's taking in the substrate.
You have a series of nutrients, so some linear combination of them.
Well, yeah. So this is in a coarse grain sense. Okay.
I think some sort of phenomenological thing, right? You have a certain amount of certain nutrients in your body.
Yes.
And the question is, how many proteins, enzymes do you have to express to get a certain amount of building blocks being produced in your time?
Yes.
And
yes.
It's basically that proportionality.
Yes. 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 So it's a phenomenologically defined quantity.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, defined in this way. Okay, so now this may be more than so. I should remind you that so this was the Monod's renal curve, and we see so Monod changed this nu by changing the density of the substrates outside. Okay, but you can also change it by internally by you can dial by changing different types of nutrients or changing the uptake properties of uptake protein. So the nu contains is a linear relation to this substrate. Okay. now, in fact, if you look at this, so this is looks like an enzyme. So the statement is that the cell growth, as far as growth is concerned, the cell can be regarded just as an enzyme with the enzyme being the ribosome. Okay. Running. And the substrate being the nutrient that's taken in. And this may be more than just a coincidence. So first thing notice is that, so there's a number that's sitting up front, right? These are determined by, I would say basic constants of the cell, okay? And it pops out to be rather close to the known fastest growth rate for E. coli, okay? But of course, this could be coincidence, so we need to check that. For everything, I like to have at least three tests, three different ways of checking to see whether we are on some reasonable ground. So the way to check this is this is Ohm's law, right? So I want to change the voltage and see how the current change. Okay? So to change the voltage, I need to change its fine mass, okay, which is this thing. But this thing involves hundreds of proteins. I cannot change it. So then what we can do is to ask the cell to express some protein it doesn't need. Okay, so this is a one contact with a topic that people are talking about here, the fitness cost of a useless protein, right? So let's force the cell to express some protein it doesn't need, right? And see what's the effect on the rate of cell growth. So according to this simple Ohm's law, then you expect, of course, a linear decrease. So all that will happen here is just this R max will be reduced by this amount. Okay. Now the thing here is that all numbers are fixed. Okay, this is all being determined from the, you know, measurements of ribosome properties, ribosome, things like that. Okay, so this is a zero parameter prediction, and here are the lines of the predictions according to the basic constant that's measured, and then here are the experimental data. Okay, so I want to point out that this x-axis is the fraction of this one enzyme that's overexpressed. Okay, so in this experiment, this enzyme is an NACZ, and we managed to express up to, so 30% of the cell is filled with this one protein that doesn't need. Okay, and you see that the growth rate just drops more or less linearly. Okay.
If you ask if the number of mRNA associated with that much bigger than the 30, you would think from 30%?
The number of mRNA?
Yeah.
Well, mRNA is usually much lower than ribosome. mRNA is constantly being turned over. The typical lifetime of mRNA is a few minutes, right? So over a cell doubling time, it's several tens, the factor of several tens below. So mRNA doesn't play much of a role in this kind of problem.
No, I know it doesn't, yeah. But if I ask, okay, how much lactate would I have expected in there? Right? Is it reducing
so
much?
So if you ask that question, you're asking for trouble. Rate. You have to work much harder. Right. So you see, so what I'm hiding in these plots is what I did to get this protein to express that much. Okay.
Yeah.
So as long as you take this just as a hidden variable, so that this is the implicit relation between these things, this works it's very simple to get this relation.
Yeah.
But what you're asking, how much you should expect and so forth, well, this has to do with all kind of molecular mechanisms, or what about RNA polymerase availability, this and that.
So those are other feedbacks to determine what fraction of
So I don't care how it gets to this level, but I do something until it gets to this level and just look at the growth rate. All right, so that's that. So now we would like to compare this to some literature result on this, because a lot of people have been expressing proteins, right? And this is already in the 90s, and this is a big thing for biotechnology. Now, for most of the studies, it's difficult to make a direct comparison because people often report things in relative changes, and then they cannot compare, okay? And so that's another thing for those students that are learning to the experiment. Try to record absolute amounts. Okay, biology only tell you relative is enough, but try the reporting absolute amounts. Okay, numbers can really help you to distinguish different phenomena, different strategies, different scenarios. Right. So we found several works, in particular by Chuck Curran's group. So this blue data set is this one. So this is the glucose minimal median. So this is the one that most people work on. Right. So if you look at this, so this is for different type of protein that's overexpressed, okay, and I have no idea how they overexpress their thing, okay, we don't care about that, but you see more or less before on the same chart, right, it's for different type of proteins, different promoted, different expression system, and all of that, okay, and again, this is absolute, right, this is absolute abundance and growth rate, no scaling parameter whatsoever. It's very important to really show the actual numbers to see when it's some relation. Now it's of course in a mature field like physics we can scale all the things away once you understand things, right? But in biology you're in such a beginning stage, you really need to go back to the basic and look at the raw numbers. Okay, so that was test number one, where we look at the cost of useless proteins. So the next thing is I would say, well, let's look at the cost of a useful protein. But that's a big can of worms, right? Useful is in the eye of the beholder. So we say, well, let's invent a useful for the protein, right? So what we consider is we grow cells in antibiotics, right? And then we express a protein that provides the cell with antibiotic resistance. So that's the use. So we look at the several translation inhibiting drugs, but I'll just talk about chlorpheniclone, which inhibits translation. Biochemical property is well known. And I just told you how ribosomes relate to growth. Okay. And so we express a protein, this protein that modifies the chlorpheniclone, okay, and in an unregulated manner. Okay, so it turned out that when cells are inhibited by translation, then there's a positive relation between growth and the constitutive gene expression. And that, let me just show you, so this is the empirical data. Each color is for a different nutrient. And then the series is generated by applying chlorpheniclone to reduce the translation, to reduce growth. And you see there is the vertical axis is a constitutively expressed protein. Okay, and you see there's a linear relation for each medium. Okay, and where does that come from? It actually comes, it's a corollary of the growth law, the growth theory I described a moment ago, but I'm not going to go into that. Just take that as an empirical relation. But basically, as translation is inhibiting the cell, compensates by opening up this ribosome sector, and it squeezes down all other proteins, and that's why this unregulated protein goes there. Okay.
So what are the different colors?
The what? So each is a different nutrient. Okay, and for each nutrient, you inhibit translation. Very important what you keep fixed, what will you change. Okay, so then you see that there is a positive feedback relating these quantities. Okay, mainly, so the more you inhibit a cell, the less this resistant protein is expressed, then even more the drug. Right? And so you can work out the phase diagram of the system, so everything is known about the conditional relations, and you get something like that, where you expect for some regime the cell grows, some regime does not grow, and then there's a coexistence. Okay, so, and then there's one effective parameter that has to do with the concentration of the degree of a cat expression in absence of a drug. So, to do an easy experiment to test this, okay, so you make a string, constitutively express this cat protein, right, and then you measure its growth in the batch culture for various external concentrations. You see that there is an abrupt drop. You take the abrupt, so this abrupt drop, sort of, so there's one unknown parameter, which is fixed by the location of this abrupt drop at certain concentrations, and then that fixes the entire theory, okay? And so, for example, this line, is this drawn just based on the position of this, okay? So then the next thing you can ask is, well, what about in this coexistence region? Okay, so then we went into use microfluidics and look at the cells, and you see that some, you know, two cells next to each other, some cells growing, some cells not growing. Okay, so there's bistability, and characterize the fraction of growing, not growing things in this transition region. And so there's you can catch the lower bound, which I'm not showing, I'm just giving you a 2-3 page of an abstract report of this study. This lower bound also is where it's predicting. And then what we can do is we can vary the basal expression level of this protein. That's the only parameter. Okay, and so basically scan across this line. We can measure where this horizontal axis is and measure these two points, and you see these. So these are the kill curves for along different degree of this expression. So I understand there was some discussion on the nature and shape of this kill curve, and there's a critical point here. Below that point, so you see this is a smooth hill coefficient type of behavior, but above that there's this abrupt behavior. Okay, and so it's very easy to define the MIC, because when you have an abrupt transition like that, certainly the location of transition is the MIC. So turning to fitness, then of course the growth rate as measured could be taken as a measure of a fitness, right? And then so what we have is then a fitness landscape which depends. Okay, so if you read this way, so this is the fitness, and this is the genetic parameter, right? So like in what was discussed yesterday was the evolution, so different activity of the proteins, that will also, activity is a parameter in here that will change. Or in our experiment, we're changing the expression level, right? So this will be the landscape. So it is a plateau fitness landscape. But more than that, we also, in this theory, you see that how this landscape depends on the confinable drug concentration, which is a property of the environment. Right, so this is an explicit example of an environment-dependent fitness landscape. Right, so if you know something about environment, we can entertain how evolution will work using this kind of landscape.
And history dependent because of this part.
There's a lot of So basically, in our study, we just carry over to this stage, and I think everybody in the audience would know what to do with this curve, so we don't need to do it. Okay. All right. So this is about just constitutive expression of some protein that might be useful, not useful, or how it affects growth. So the next thing I want to talk about is a regulated gene expression, how that relates to growth. Okay. So for a long time, I thought that these simple linear relations we've been observing and been playing with, probably not unreasonable for something special like ribosome, so regulated in complicated ways, and maybe not unreasonable for unregulated promoters. Okay, but then we start seeing evidence that even regulated gene expression had obeyed these simple relations. And for several years, basically, I just refused to believe it. Right? So data were mounting in the lab, but just didn't believe it. But ultimately, at some point, I could not ignore it. Well, we collectively could not ignore it anymore, and we took it seriously. Okay, and that's the next thing I'll describe to you. So let me talk about this in the context of a capillary repression, which is one of the classic phenomena in microbiology. Right? This is something that occurs for many microbes. So it is known that if you feed microbes with E. coli and many others with glucose, okay, then the expression of many other enzymes, the catabolic enzyme, the enzyme that can bring carbons, inhibited. It's called a glucose effect. And this is best displayed in this study monoded on the glucose lactose dioxy. I'll talk much more about this towards the end of the talk, but it's just to orient us. So you grow E. coli, he grew E. coli in a medium with glucose and lactose. So he first grew, consuming glucose, and then there's a gap, and then after glucose is depleted, then the cell turns on enzyme that can digest lactose, and after it's expressed enough, then start to consume lactose. Okay. So this was really the beginning of a study of regulation, right? Because obviously the cell is smart, it's doing something, it's computing something. Okay, then that's, well, why is that? That led to discovery of the lab system. So how is this dioxy implemented? Boris Magasanik wrote in a very famous article 50 years ago, he wrote an article that described the phenomena and coined the name catabolite repression. Right? He proposed that some catabolites would form rapidly from glucose. Okay, and this is a catabolite that would accumulate also if the cell were taking other carbons. Okay, and then this catabolite represses the synthesis of these other enzymes. Okay, because there's already enough of these catabolites. Okay. These catabolites were later research never found these catabolites. Never established these catabolites. Okay, there is one story about Monod. Maybe I will mention more at the end. So Monod's very last paper, where his name appeared, it was published after he was deceased. This very last paper was, oh, we found a substance, okay, that behaves like this catabolites, okay, but then sort of people treat it like Fermat's last theorem, mm-hmm. and they just kind of okay. But never mind about these catabolites. People found that the a interesting molecule, cyclic MP, okay, it sort of does the opposite of what the catabolites are supposed to do. Okay, so during the starvation period, cyclic AMP shoots up. So then biologists decide, okay, even though we don't know what these catabolites are, we have cyclic AMP, and we can follow it and follow what it interacts with, how it regulates, and everything. Okay, so the downstream research in the 60s and 70s will really clarify the regulation by this cyclic AMP molecules. And it is thought that the cyclic AMP is responding, it is implementing this dioxy and it's implementing this glucose, this dioxy and the catabolic repression. Except the role of cyclic AMP to dioxy is a lie. Okay? And why is that a lie? It's a very well hidden lie. Okay, so people have done experiments that deleted the cell of the capability to synthesize cyclic AMP, and you repeat the experiment, you get the same. Okay, so no, if you read textbook, you would never see this, right? But this was published almost 20 years ago, and this is not the only one. Even before that, in the 70s, people already sort of evidence that this has nothing to do with dioxin. Okay, so then we look at this problem. We have a number of questions. So the first question for me is why this effect? This phenomenon is very general, that you grow cells in glucose or in other good carbons, the gene expression of the expression of catabolic proteins decrease. Why does a cell do that? Physiological rationale. And then what are the catabolites? Then how the cyclic AMP levels are controlled. And then we'll see that all of this, we do not even need to invoke two carbons. We look at a single carbon, can already answer these questions. And then what happens, but the cell does make a choice between different carbon sources. So what underlies its rational decision to make to utilize multiple carbon sources? Okay, so this is what I'll be talking
about. From what is it clear that this catabolites even exist?
The what?
Now, why do we know that these catabolites even exist?
Well, because I'm going to tell you what they are. Okay. But you don't need the catabolite. You have cyclic AMP. But the question is, well, who controls what cyclic AMP level is? How does cyclic AMP send? What's the meaning of a cyclic AMP signal? Okay.
You're saying the signal isn't needed anywhere.
Huh?
The signal isn't needed.
No, the signal is not needed for this dioxy, but the signal is needed for something else. Okay, and that something else, even for that something else, it is known who give rise to this. What is the signaling for?
So both this dioxy shift and the CMP are controlled by
something unknown. Okay, and the molecular biologists were happy to pursue the downstream the course and then sort of not worry about what came from. And I would say this is really not just for E. coli; it is a symptom that you see everywhere in signaling. Right, everybody that has studied signaling. Okay, the biggest unknown is what triggers the signal. Any signaling system you ask, all you know is something, some perturbation can trigger the signal. But you do not know whether that signal is intended for that. What is intended? Okay. So here's how we're going to study this system. So we're going to, instead of measuring cyclic AMP itself, which is very difficult because it's a very low level and excrete out of the cell, we're going to measure the consequence of cyclic AMP signal, right? So cyclic AMP through the helper transferrin factor regulates hundreds of genes. So we pick one of the genes, the best characterized gene in molecular biology, the LAC system. Okay? The LAC system has two input. We deactivate one of the input. So everything I'm going to tell you about is the expression of the system, and it's a basic report of cyclic AMP activity. So what we did was we grew cells in a number of different carbon sources, right? Record its growth rate, and record its expression level. So expression level means the amount of the activity of this protein, which is a proxy for the amount of this protein per total protein, okay, which was the density. Okay, but then for convenience, we look at a per optical density, and we establish optical density and the total proteins are independent of the growth. Okay, so this axis here to think of it as a fraction of this laxity protein per total protein. Okay, and so this is just a scatter plot of this table, right? So growth rate on the right hand side, and this laxity, the expression, the output on the left hand side. Okay, so looks intriguing, but what does it mean? We're changing, so each of this is a different carbon source. Everything could be changing. We don't know what it means. Okay, now based on the model I presented earlier, the simple growth model, we had a hunch that maybe this change is changing this new parameter. Okay, that it's changing the quality of the carbon, or the changing the influx of the carbon. So then we decided to do the experiment to directly test that, and So here, just show some representative carbon. Glucose is here, lactose is here. Okay, the cell actually goes faster on lactose than glucose. Okay, so this thing about why glucose is preferred over lactose is just a lie. Okay, many lies in.
I've never seen that before.
The what? Okay, so if you look at Monod's original strain, okay, look at this data. Lactose is slightly faster than glucose. So this MI is something. Okay. But certainly it's not much slower, okay? It's comparable. So in this case, the distance is because of the fact that we're expressing laxity. Okay, but if we're not expressing laxity, it is here. Okay? It's not slower.
Right, so LACI is gone, right?
Either LACI is gone or we use IPTG to disable. All right, so what are we doing? So we're seeing some correlation, but what are we changing? Right? So let's say, well, let's do experiments so that we know what we're changing. Right? So what we did here was to titrate the expression of the lac permease, which is the only route for lactose getting to the cell. Overexpressing this permease does not mean the cell will grow faster, because there's other kind of internal bottlenecks. Right? But if I decrease the expression of this guy, eventually, the cell has to grow slow. This is, we're choking the input, right? Okay, so we still measure laxity expression using the native promoter, okay? And so we use some chemical to titrate the expression level, and we get these results. Okay, so this is wild-type lactose. So as we decrease lac-y expression, growth slows down, G expression increases, just fill up this gap, okay? We're still suspicious that this will maybe fool, you know, tricked by the cell. So we did another similar type of a thing. Now we titrate glycerol uptake. Okay. This is wild-type glycerol, and this is as we reduce the glycerol uptake. Okay. So at this point, so
all of these growth rates are estimated from ODs.
Sorry,
you're using optical density data.
So we do a separate test for each OD, for each medium. We measure the OD, we measure the total protein, right? And then we see that they're more or less flat, 5-10% different, which is not meaningful in this.
Okay, so you're not looking at CFU or looking at cells, individual cell growth.
Per total, we were talking about laxity per total protein, basically. That's OD is a report for total protein.
Well, Bruce is asking about how you're measuring definition of the growth rate.
Growth rate is just in batch culture exponential. You can really, every measurement is taken only after 7 doubling. Okay, 7, 8 doubling. Hopefully, 10 doubling is very demanding. Okay, but as much exponential as possible. Okay, so we don't have to worry about what is the maximum growth rate or whatever. Just you know, really we're measuring it in exponential growth. Okay. So I should make a peripheral remark that everything we're talking about here, the technology is so primitive, and everything could have been done 50 years ago. Okay, and so this, I guess, the hallmark of a theorist doing experiment. We're not chasing cutting-edge technology, doing something that's very basic that everybody can repeat. Right. So this kind of a study. So there's we minimize the chance of getting fooled by technology. Okay. Of course, this can be done in a high throughput way, by modern technology. But these experiments, the not done experiments, could be done by hand. All right. So what this result indicates, that is, this is really responding. This is a behavior. This is a response to reduction in the influx of carbon. That's at least what we tried. Okay. Okay, and we'll describe again right now. Okay, but actually I slipped something on you. Yes, we reduce the carbon, but to generate this change. But maybe this is a response to any kind of a growth rate change, right? So control experiments is in order that we change something else, not carbon, right? So then we decide to change nitrogen. Okay, so reduce this again. Use a titratable system. So we choke the influx of nitrogen. It's only passed to bring nitrogen into the cell. And so what would you expect? Look up the textbook, say if you change nitrogen, nothing. There's going to be no effect on the lab promoter, right? But if you think about it in a common sense way, the cell is basically carbon plus nitrogen, right? And if you reduce nitrogen, there's no reason for it to take in so much carbon. Maybe it also reduces the carbon expression. And this is exactly what we saw. So for each set of a color is for a fixed carbon source, right? It's very important to fix something and change only one thing. And so we fix carbon source and dial down nitrogen, growth rate goes down, gene expression goes down for these three cases that we looked at. Okay? Actually, I can blow each of them up and you'll see that there's a linear thing going down. And if the reason I was giving for why it goes down is true, then it should not be just nitrogen. We can limit something else that's non-carbon. And here's the limitation by sulfur. This we did in a chemostat. Just get sick and tired of making these titratable constructs.
How far down are you going with, say, the glucose? What concentration are you going
down? Oh, this is when we fix the carbon, it is all saturating concentration. Okay, 0.2%, 0.5%. I don't know. So glucose is definitely not running out. Okay, in these experiments, the nitrogen is also in saturating concentration, right? So we're titrating the uptake. So we know what we're doing.
Have you looked at any of these strains by microscopy under these conditions? To see how homogeneous the growth rates are within the population?
Yeah. So what we do with the microfluidics we do not spend a lot of effort quantifying, but we mainly look for sort of to sort of cover our back. That is, there's no bimodal or something. So we see a uniform distribution, and we just take the bulk property.
Oh, so this is a microfluidic.
No. Well, we have done so, yeah. For every one of these, we have done batch culture, microfluidics, chemostat. We've done all of these. Okay, but the batch culture is most reliable. So that's what I'm recording. So in supplemental material, let's see. Okay, so we have another set of straight lines. Okay, so you see that the cell is responding in an extremely rational way, right, to carbon and nitrogen limitation. Although we have also studied the underlying molecular mechanism, very complicated. There's one more control that is, if you delete the input of a CRP, the cyclin P, to this promoter, then it disappears. All these relations disappear. Okay, so all of this nice, simple linear relation come from complex regulation entering through this binding site. All right, so on the side, I'll tell you, so we also look at the behavior of a number of other CRP-regulated promoters, okay? If you look at the annotation, they're very different from the lac promoters. We looked at the five or six of them. Let me just show you a few. Right, so this glycerol uptake promoters. There's overall scaling of the vertical axis because the lac Z amount, it's just a reporter, right? The different promoter, the translation will be different. But they all have linear behavior and pointing to the same intercept. And so in this linear relation, the nice thing about linear relation for theorists, of course, is that there's this one, two number to follow. And in this case, especially the vertical axis is not so meaningful. It's just this number that's essential. This number is telling you that as carbon is not limiting, how fast it's going. Okay, so like the speed limit, right, if you're varying carbon. Okay, so to understand this linear relation, we again go back to the simple proteome partition model. Except that now, instead of, before I showed you this one section for metabolic proteins, now since I'm specifically limiting carbon and nitrogen, then I want to divide it into catabolic and anabolic sections. Okay, and then the three of them add up to a constant. So the ribosome, of course, still has a linear dependence. This is specifically checked for the peculiar way that we do nutrient limitation. And this lac-z behavior, this set of lines, is we take it to be a proxy of this catabolic sector, right? So what it's saying is under carbon limitation, okay, so ribosomes are decreasing because growth rate slows down, okay, and then this, what the cell responds to is to fill the space ribosome vacated by catabolic protein. Makes a lot of sense. You don't need that much ribosome, and you should express catabolic protein to help you if you're carbon limited. All right, and the opposite picture for anabolic limitation, nitrogen, sulfur, and so forth. And so ribosomes going down, catabolic protein expression is also going down. So then immediately there's a prediction that there should be a complementary section of the gene, the proteome, that's expanding in the linear way, right? And so we looked at the half a dozen or so anabolic reporters. Here's one. The promoter of glutamine synthetase, a important player in bringing nitrogen, making glutamine in this case. And you see that as under nitrogen limitation, catabolic protein goes down, and this anabolic protein increases, and vice versa for carbon.
So I guess why are the anabolic proteins going
up? Why? Okay, so. Yeah, okay, the rationale is that just like why would the catabolic protein go up here, right? So if, okay, you do not need to make so many ribosomes that decreases, okay? And then what are you going to fill your protein with? You might as well fill with the thing that you need.
But why do you need more anabolic in this
circumstance? Molecularly, maybe it is to, so you have more enzyme to push some more flux through. So the flux is a part of enzyme and the substrate, right? So if you reduce the substrate, then they respond by increasing the channel.
Sorry, actually, related question. So what's the definition of catabolic enzyme? Something involved in
I'll show you.
Okay. Breakdown of carbon.
So in this case, yeah, I mean carbon catabolic. So because limiting carbon, so when you see this, well, you see lac-z is an example of a carbon uptake, and I'll show you in the last page several of these catabolic.
But similarly, yeah. Anabolic is what?
Amino acid synthesis. In this case, we're limiting nitrogen, okay?
But it could also be phosphorus or sulfur.
Yeah, so if it's phosphorus, then there will be other. So here we're talking about, yeah.
Should I be prepared to partition your
anabolic? Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So this is looking at one particular. I mean, when you write down energy for a magnet, you have a field, temperature, blah blah blah, right? I mean, but I'm just limiting the space to the two things that we are putting.
But the catabolic includes imports.
Yes.
Import
is a big
sort of method. There's a rough transition between catabolic.
So, right? Does it only include import of carbon or nitrogen as well?
Right? So in this case, I'm limiting carbon, so I expect only the carbon. Okay, but then there are also some mixed ones that the amino acid transporter. Amino acid could be used as a carbon source. Right. Okay.
It's actually easier for me to understand if you, for example, said that nitrogen importer is counted in A, so that nitrogen is limiting, I'm actually increasing
the
efficiency of nitrogen.
So nitrogen importer happens to be the one I'm tuning. Okay. Yeah. So we have looked inside of cell, and at this moment, I mean, just phenomenology, all right? And it's as good as it leads to new experiments and right prediction. But I'm going to tell you what they are. Okay.
So, I mean, very intuitive. Like, so you choke it on something.
Yeah.
And then the flux is still has to be matched.
Yes.
Ribosome number goes down.
Yes.
Something else.
Yeah. Something is going to go up.
So
the
flux is matching.
Yes. Yes.
What is sort of very surprising to me, I keep not being able to wrap my head around, is that the claim seems to be that the amount of flux you get is always linear in how much you change the amount of protein. Whereas I could have imagined there's a very nonlinear function, right?
That you can imagine that's why, you know, I get surprised by these things so many times. My thinking is always more complicated than what it was telling me, right? So this is linear. You have a linear relation between, and we'll see that it's not just this protein. You have hundreds of these carbon uptake proteins behaving this way. Okay, so take it, simple, take it.
You find it surprising too?
Of course I find it surprising. Didn't expect it. Didn't believe it for many years.
But is this a product of tuning it by?
Yes.
Is it a product of limiting by of tuning by nitrogen? I mean, I realize you have to do this.
So we tune by nitrogen. We tune by translation. It's also linear. Okay, so if we inhibit cone panicle, so that was I actually showed you that earlier for this. But if you inhibit by translation, it's right on top of these, the expression right on top of.
What about if you gave it an amino acid that it could use as both carbon and nitrogen?
Yes. Okay. Then it's complicated. Okay, because the amino acid has both carbon and nitrogen. Okay.
But
so I'm not showing that.
But
I'm not showing
limiting
that.
There. I wonder. If, you know,
I think now we can go back and understand because you compose into carbon. So now, when you're putting amino acid, you're giving a mixed perturbation.
That's
okay,
right.
Just more complicated.
And change the animal influence too.
Yeah. Just right. So basically, the approach here is to design experiment so that the results are easy to interpret. Of course, you can do a lot of convenient perturbation, and you do a perturbation, you get a result that you just scratch your hair, you don't know how to.
But you would still know if you took an amino acid that delivered carbon and nitrogen, that let's say nitrogen was limiting.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested to know where that nitrogen limitation sat with regard to the linear lines that you present. Does the cell, when it gets to make the decision about what is limiting,
yeah,
deliver the same as you see when you tune it?
Well, I'm going to build up a piece by piece. We're not at the adding amino acid yet, okay? I can tell you what happened when you add a second carbon, okay? Just little by little, we see what's handleable, okay? And then we'll find out. Yeah.
Can you build a thought
from
what coding you see in the previous day?
Yeah.
I'm sort of wondering, as well, why it really never changes,
and you're
being very tricky on yourself.
Yes, yes. Okay, so
you could dump quite a lot of things.
Yeah, these are all great questions, and I was, like everybody else in the room, spoiled by statistical mechanics. Okay, we're used to thinking about having a model and go upward, right? But progress in science usually goes the other way. You first do phenomenology, you understand behavior, then you go in and ask and so forth. Okay, so I take this model. The only virtue of this model is that, you know, it reproduces the overexpression data using a 50%. So this Q is the only fudge parameter in this model. Okay, and it's actually experimentally determined. Okay, and then in this antibiotic stability, and then we'll see some other stuff. Okay, but then yes, we'll peek into the cell to find out what they are. But I wish we don't have to do that. I'm surprised in the physics talk that I'm asked. This is what biologists ask all the time, right? What's in there?
Some fraction orders have become perverted.
The what?
Some fraction orders have become perverted methods.
No, I mean, I think it's a really a problem with physics education. Because we teach our students, we teach thermodynamics through statistical mechanics. Okay? We Okay. So, this behavior can then be summarized by a serial circuits, which is one component becomes two components. Okay, and basically you have three parameters. The translation rate is known, and for each carbon nitrogen source, there is one such parameter. Okay, and they determine the anchor point. So the way these things work is that so they're constrained between the set of relations, right? So if you change the carbon source, okay, from glucose to glycerol, then you have a this line instead of that line, and this then reflects itself in shifting this line to there. Okay, so there's a precise relation: how much increase there, how much change there, and this kind of thing could be checked. Okay, and ultimately you describe, you know, plot everything in a three-dimensional plot, Yes, you can, first is that these three sections have to add up to a constant, but then there's more subtle relation between the position of these lines and so on. Okay. So, these are the things that physicists are not supposed to like. Okay, so what are inside of these different sectors, right? So we look at the proteomics, okay? And so that allows us to follow thousands of proteins, 1,000 protein. And so under carbon limitation, and then the nitrogen limitation, and under translation limitation by Cohn-Vanacore, okay? And so if you look at it, clearly your eye tells you that the response breaks down into several clusters, okay? And the nice thing about proteomics is that so each of these up and down, there's you can target absolute amount of protein, okay? And you can add them up. So doing coarse graining is easy, right? And what I've been telling you about the fractions, phi and so forth, just the sum of everything in this book. Okay, so all we do is we use any algorithm to do a clustering and add up all them.
But if you do like clustering and then you look at the names of all these proteins.
Yeah, you can look at the names of all these
proteins. Then it sort of makes sense with the picture.
Well, you see, right? This is the ones that respond to the catabolic limitation, the carbon limitation, okay, and the nitrogen and the translational limitation. Basically, these guys go down in a similar way. So if you look at individual ones, there's a up and down noise, uncertainty, everything. Okay, but when you add up, very simple relation. Look at another sector, this responds to nitrogen limitation, and it's in this paper. Okay, so what we were guessing based on a few reporters. Let's see. Okay, so we do this, and in this case, we end up with six sectors. So one thing we did not anticipate was that, so there is a sector. The sector of the proteins under both carbon nitrogen limitation increases. So this just tends to respond to slow down growth. Okay, that's a missing sector. Okay, and you can analyze the terms, the most frequent terms are weighted by this abundance. And you see, so in this carbon sector, so all the transporters, okay, very important, the TCA, that's for energy generation, and the motility. All the motility proteins, okay, the flagella, the huge systems. About a third of these guys are motility proteins. Okay, so suggesting that E. coli thinks of motility as a part of the carbon scavenging mechanism. But under nitrogen limitation, under translation limitation, motility is quickly turned. So on and so forth. So about the question of what is in this cube, okay? So actually, there's some residue here. 20%, it's in, okay, but in every one of these sectors, there's an offset. Okay, so two-thirds of what's in this queue are these offset. Okay, so in a way, I was classifying in this theory, they will count as queue. They do not participate in the research. Okay, and we can spend a lot of time discussing, in fact, that's what we're working on, what is the role of these guys? Because it's always very important by reducing them, the cell can grow faster. Right, but then you see a lot of it is allocated to that.
You haven't mentioned the distinction membrane and cytoplasmic proteins, whose ratio presumably, well, at least my guess, changes.
Yes. So this is something we are working on now. This protein method we're using now, it mostly focuses on cytoplasmic protein. Okay, but the amount of protein that's covered though is like 80-85% of the total protein. The membrane protein is small, by total abundance is a small amount of the total protein. But it's certainly, it will be very important, and we're developing methods to look at the membrane protein.
More
enough.
Yes.
So I always thought of this Q as sort of the proteins that you need when you're in the most fantastic environment, where you're basically, all the rest is all R.
Okay.
And then there's a set of problems that you still have to make, even in the best environment for the cell you possibly make.
So, that's your interpretation. That was my interpretation too. Okay. But in the phenomenology, there's no interpretation. Okay. It just works. Right. So every estimate we have to use, the skew is always around 50%. Okay. The emerging picture to me, it is that all of this thing is highly controlled, it's preset, right? And so for whatever reason, which we can entertain, that right, the cell basically sets half of the protein for something else. Half of it is for growth optimization, half for something else. And that something else, so my guess is that is for kinetics. Okay? Because you see, if you're going from slow growth to fast growth, if it's a completely linear, you have to spend a lot of time making these proteins, right? But if you have an offset, it's much faster. Okay, so we're thinking about that. We're testing that. Okay, but I don't think it's for a kinetic reason. But right, so well, half of it is for something else.
So in the earlier slides before the proteomics, you were looking at single reporters,
yes.
Right? You attach some fluorescent to
yes.
one gene, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This was pretty linear, right?
Yeah.
Now you have a lot of reporters.
Yes.
And you say they go up and down, and you
yes.
have to average.
Yes. Yeah. So it should just average out. No, but I showed you a number of catabolic uptake transporters, right? They all have the same linear dependence.
Right. So
right.
Why do they fluctuate so much now if you do the?
Why do they what?
Why do you have all this fluctuation for the protein?
No, not fluctuation. These are offsets. So different proteins have different offsets.
Okay.
So this you can see we can pull out the individual proteins, right? So it's clear there's an offset and there's a linear dependence. All right, so all of this then eventually answers the first question, which is why catabolite repression, okay? So what's catabolite repression? It is the generic down, the inhibition of carbon catabolic proteins as in fast growth. And why is that? Well, our answer is that for this protein balance, okay? So this works like a funiculum. As you go fast, there's obligatory demand to increase the ribosome in the cell, okay? And then you need to take it off something, and you take it off kind of out. Okay, so very quickly on the strategy of this coordination. So how could a cell do this? Right? It's the fact that it is doing this, but how can a cell do this? How does it coordinate carbon and nitrogen? So we ask, so in this very simple cross-grain view, carbon coming in, nitrogen coming in, making amino acid. Well, what will happen if these two are not coordinated? Right? If they're not coordinated, well, then this pool will feel the right? If these two fluxes are not the same. Okay, so then we already know that cyclin P controls these catabolic proteins. Okay, so then a simple guess is that this pool will go back and inhibit cyclin P. Right? So then in this way, you see, if you have lots of carbon coming in, right, then this pool will increase and go down and suppress these proteins. So this will be responsible for this coming down. But if you have a limitation in nitrogen, this pool will also increase. So the same mechanism can explain this guy going down. Right? And so we tested this. Okay? And the way we tested it was so for cell growing in exponential phase, we just dump in the suspected precursors. Right, and what we suspected were the carbons that were the last point before ammonia is added to make amino acid. Okay, so this is a class of a chemical called keto acids, and we added these. So oxaloacetate is one of these keto acids. Okay, so this is a function of time. So before the addition, cells were growing, and the lactate expression were increasing on several different carbon sources. Right, upon addition. That's the expression of complete suppression. Okay? After some period of re-equilibration, it's going in. And this is a control where just the CRP binding sites are scrambled. Then doing the same experiment, there's no change. Okay? So we tested this for a number of these popular keto acids, and they all have a strong repression effect. Okay? So this then answers the second question, what are the catabolites, right? So I think Magasanis' original picture was very reasonable, and the catabolites are at least a class of alpha keto acids, the catabolites. And finally, there's an issue about mechanism, the one we'll get into, but we various leads led to the protein that actually synthesized cyclin P. Okay, and so we did a in vitro assay, and in the presence of these chemicals, the activity of a cyclin P synthesis is just greatly reduced. Okay, so that would be the the hub. Okay, so there's a demonstration starting from the top, right, and going down. Once you know the rationale, then you can go down and check, well, how this could be done eventually, what's the molecular components for doing this. And so then everything I've talked about is about a single carbon, right, the cells growing on a single carbon. I started with talking about multiple carbon, right? So the rest is a multiple carbon, but I have another. Is it time? Do I have
any? Well, I have a little bit more time.
Okay. Okay. So then who takes care of a multiple carbon? So what does the cell do when you present it with the two carbons? Right. So it's known for a long time that the two strategies, some carbons are used incorporate together, some there's a preferential incorporation. Okay. So here's an example. We use a number of carbons, and the red are the growth rate on the single carbon, okay, and the green are the growth rate in the combination of two carbons. Everything is saturating amounts. Okay, so we don't have to play with the concentrations. The ones that's graded out are the ones basically the growth rate on the two carbons is close to the growth rate on the faster of the single carbon. Okay, so that we do not know whether there would be multiple usage. But these guys in clear are all the ones with growth rate exceed the fastest growth rate. Okay, so the presumably there's some interaction maybe that makes usage. Okay, the question is, can we understand the green numbers given the red numbers? So the way we think about it is that so we have two type of fluxes coming in, produce a total carbon flux, right? And there's an enzyme system responsible for each. Okay, if we're talking about single carbon, then we know that there's a linear relation. This is a C line describing the amount of this enzyme and the growth rate, with lambda C being the speed limit. And now we have two of these systems, right? And we make the assumption that let's say there's no interaction, there'll be the no model. Okay, if the only thing that's happening is just these two carbon influx dumps work together, make a total net flux, is the sum of the two. Okay, so and additionally, since we think sigma P is responding to the total carbon flux, its job is to balance the total carbon flux with nitrogen, sulfur, and so forth, right? Then we assume that that these two will respond in the same way, except that now with two carbons, it will be the growth rate on the two carbons. This is the simplest no model you can put for this. Okay, so then you can work out a growth rate addition formula, right? So it is formula like the relativistic velocity addition formula. So there's a speed limit that is the fastest rate the cell can grow. And if you're far from that limit, then it's just the sum of the two, right? And if you're pushing close to it, at least one of them pushing close to it, they eventually just saturate by this limit. Okay? And this is how it works. So first of all, that we check both. So with two carbons, the green points are on two carbons, they still follow the same C line as the single carbon source, right? And then this is the expected for this formula and then the risk check. Okay, so certainly we're going to see that this is tracking this behavior, and there's absolutely no fudge parameters, right? Just this is a speed limit that's determined from a single carbon, and it's how it is. So this sets the baseline. Oh, and one feature of this is that so even though say there's a simple addition, but because they're both regulated by the system, you expect that there's a compensation. So like if initially it's grown on one carbon source, and now if you increase the second carbon source, then to make up the system, then there's an adjustment. This picture, simple picture, expected adjustment. So, and this is observed. So, like if you look at the pyruvate and the glycerol, here's the pyruvate uptake. If pyruvate is the only carbon source, when you add glycerol, growth rate is faster, but the pyruvate uptake is actually slower, just by the amount that's expected by this theory. Okay, so then what about hierarchical carbon usage? So how is it implemented? Well, so this is a subject of, I guess these days, of industrial interest. There's a lot of people are growing bacteria to break down cellulose and so forth, right? And it's kind of a pain to wait for it to eat glucose up first before breaking down the other stuff, right? So you see papers, many papers, there's a paper by Jay Keesing group who say, hey, we've discovered something that is some bug where the biopsy is absent and they can simultaneously use the glucose and the xylose to break down. Here, this paper says, oh, we found some mutation where we can get rid of this high glucose usage, right? So it'll be good to see how this high glucose usage is implemented. If you understand that, maybe you can manipulate it, maybe even change the order or something. Okay, so let's go back to diopsy. This is what I started with. So you grow cells in glucose and a glycerol, right? And so this is optical density again. And you see that initially, so this is the remaining, the glucose that's remaining in the medium. Initially, it grows on glucose. After glucose runs out, okay, there's a waiting period when the cell has to do something. And at some point, they start consuming glycerol and increases. Right? So then to understand this hierarchy, we need to understand something in here that's not easy to study, because everything's changing. Yes?
Did you ever look at the... We found when we were looking at this kind of thing that glucose is gone about 1.5 divisions before they reach in glucose limited minimal medium. You can't find glucose anymore.
With two carbon sources?
No, with a single, just glucose.
Yeah.
If you look for the concentration of glucose, the glucose will be gone about at least one division before it reaches stationary phase. And that they're excreting it, acetates.
So certainly,
kind of thing, even with just a single carbon source.
Yeah. So with a certain way, it depends on the density you're starting with and a lot of the details, right? So even to get Monod realized himself that even to get this is in a sense somewhat of a gimmick, because to see this thing, you need to play with the density, inoculation density, just right away it runs out and so forth. Yes, and certainly the acetate is the important. Yes, after glucose runs out, it uses acetate, and even after acetate runs out, it can use its internal storage and so forth for a while. I'm talking about only steady state effects here, okay? And in fact, I want to modify this kinetic phenomenon. I want to study this in a steady state, so where it's easier. I want to hold sort of the frame, okay? And study what's going on, right? So then to do that, then we go back to our titratable transporter system, okay? So because we believe what's happening here is a carbon influx is running out. So all of this is happening as the carbon influx is going low, okay? So then we use our strain, and where we titrate down the carbon influx, right? And so we can study in the steady state configuration of a different, as the steady state, the flux is dialed down, see what happens, right? And so this is we titrate the glucose transporter. So this is this axis is not important, it's just some way to reduce the expression of the system. And this is the growth rate that corresponding growth rate, okay? If we grow on glycerol, then titrating the glucose transporter should not do anything, and indeed it doesn't do anything, right? So the growth rate is maintained. So what happens when we do this titrated system, but with both glucose and glycerol? Okay. So this is what happens. So first it sticks to the behavior of just lactose. First it behaves as if it's glucose alone, and then as if it's glycerol alone. Okay? Very simple behavior. So it takes the faster of the two growth rates. And so this actually it's not just even though this artificial system, the amount of this uptake titration directly affects the diopsin in this way. So where we titrate to a point where there's a crossover, then the diopsin gland disappears. Okay, because the glycerol has already been taken up. Okay, but I'm not going to talk about diopsin, just talk about this uptake system. So this is not only true for glucose and glycerol, which have many systems, glucose, maltose, glucose, xylose, and this is titrating lactose with maltose, lactose, and titrating glycerol with an even slower carbon source, have this behavior. Okay, it's always a very tight crossover. Okay. And so It takes, so the phenomenon is they always take the faster of the two growth rate, and why is that? So Boris, maybe 10 years ago, had a study on the PTS system and proposed a winner takes or strategy for the different carbon input. But clearly this is more than PTS, right? So we could test many, many systems. Okay, so we're going to look into that. So just to avoid PTS, let me study lactose and glycerol interaction. Glucose is a special PTS system, right? So we focus on this phenomena. And so we have the lac transporter uptake system bring lactose flux, glycerol uptake system bring glycerol flux, and total carbon, okay? So to explain this behavior, there's a spectrum of sort of two possibilities. One is, so clearly, okay, so when the lactose uptake system is high, lactose is used. Okay, so at this point, maybe one possibility is that there's just a switch, a switch to glycerol. Okay. Another possibility is that lactose is used always, and at this point, glycerol is used just enough to compensate for the total flux. Right? Who favors this picture? Okay, no. Okay, but anyway, so it's easy to test this. I just measure the uptake, okay, and what you see is this picture. Okay, so then it's very clear that so glycerol knows when this point is reached, okay, and it turns out just enough so that the final growth rate is just that is going on glycerol alone. Right? Okay, so how does that happen? Okay, actually it's very simple because clearly in this picture the control is on the total flux. It knows about the total flux, right? Because it's maintaining the total flux between these symbols, right? So a possible model we thought of is we'll propose is that the total flux throws a switch to limit the glycerol uptake, right? So there's some function that the two flux have added to a constant. And if there's a sharp enough increase of this control function, then you can do the job. So without lactose, okay. So without lactose at all, the system will be somewhere, and presumably this threshold will be set a bit ahead of the uptake for the glycerol, because you don't want to inhibit your own synthesis. Right? So without another carbon source, then they will not feel this threshold, right? And as you increase the lactose flux, then the glycerol flux will just decrease, right? So to have this tight crossover, just need to have a sharp threshold turn-on function and the threshold being set in a way that it doesn't inhibit the growth on the glycerol alone. All right, now, but then, biochemistry works on concentrations. You cannot have a flux controlling something. Okay, so how might this work? Well, it is known that both lactose and the glycerol flux, if you look a bit into central metabolism, it dumps into a pool of chemicals. It's rapidly equilibrated, and one of them is a FBP, fructose bisphosphate, and there's a known interaction between this and this. Okay, and furthermore, so there's a recent work that showed that the concentration of this flux, this chemical, has a linear relation with the flux. Okay, so when we were thinking about this, we were expecting there should be something like that, and just around that time, this paper came out. So great, we'll take that. So basically, this is done by a feed-forward mechanism, which we'll talk about. But anyway, so then you have a very simple mechanism where this axis is replaced by this FBP concentration rather than the flux. Okay, you can implement this. So then a test for this picture would be, well, what happens if we delete this allosteric inhibition? Okay. And then if in a simpler case, then it should revert back to the null model where we just have a straight line, right? So there was just simple carbon to velocity addition. And indeed, with looking at mutant with this interaction with a single relative mutant, a nice relation between the flux of a glycerol and the flux of the lactose. Whereas for the wild type, you have this behavior. Oops, you have this behavior, right? So this is the definition of a hierarchy, that for a range of the lactose flux, there's no glycerol flux. But beyond that, you have no coexistence. Okay? So then finally, so this is a strategy. I just want to point out that it's easily generalizable. You have a FBP that senses total flux. There could be other players. And all you need is an interaction to go back to inhibit the individual uptake systems. And you just need to arrange to have the threshold not step on itself.
Well, if you compare this with the cases where it brings in both the carbon sources together, why is this advantageous over that?
Brings in the carbon
sources? So in some of the pairs of carbon sources,
yeah.
We're using both of them.
Yeah.
And so the rate is higher than it was for either individual one. So what's the deal?
Yes. So unfortunately, so in all these other studies, we started with the physiological rationale. And then get to the, okay, so this system, there's enough machinery that's known, can figure out the mechanism and the molecular information. Why this is the case, there are many, many puzzles, okay? And this is I think this lies outside of the realm of the single bacteria, and this is one of the reasons motivating now to study ecology. Okay, yeah, so this hierarchy together with trophism and so forth.
And time-dependent environment.
Yeah. Okay, so to summarize, I hope convince you that despite the immense molecular complexity, some behavior of biology could be simple, right? But it requires doing very careful experiments, making perturbations that mostly just change one thing, not five things. Okay. And about catabolite repression, we talk about the why, what, and how, and talk about multiple carbon usage and so forth. The one thing. Say a word about is that actually so we were able to extend this steady state framework to dynamics, right? So for some simple case of dynamics where we can describe, so if you have growth on one carbon, you add a second carbon source which can be co-utilized. So this is the simplest case. Okay, we can with one adjustable parameter describe the entire growth curve. Okay, the transition. And this adjustable parameter has to do with the pre-expression level of the second, the uptake system for the second carbon source, and then go in and even change that and see that check with the prediction to see how that changes. So in terms of the unreasonable ineffectiveness of mathematics and biology, so we're going slowly now to, I think, to some area, even with differential equation, we have some confidence of solving. And in a sense of a physics, that a theory is corresponding to experiment, that's becoming possible. And so finally, just an important message for the students that's learning to do biology is the molecular versus the physiological approach, right? So molecular biology is really oriented from the bottom up. It operates under the premise by studying, understanding the interaction of the components, you can predict the large scale behavior, right? And of course, tell them, well, what would you get if you can watch the collision over 10 to the 23 particles in the room? Can you put it ideal gas law? Well, you cannot if you do not hold temperature constant, right? So the simple things you have to do in the experiment, and that's the role of physiology. Something that's very simple, you have to keep very carefully constant, and then maybe with that we can see some simplicity in biology. Okay, so. I'm gonna there's some very interesting history I'm gonna skip, and so just acknowledge the people who did the work. The first original work on this growth laws, ribosomes, and ribosomes were done by Stefan Klump and Matt Scott. Stefan is now in the Max Planck Institute in Gorm, and Matt Scott is in Ottawa as a plant mathematician. Barrett Barrett and Min Su Kim. Other worked on this antibiotic resistance problem. Min Su is actually now an Emory, a colleague of Bruce, but in the physics department. And the carbon, there's a catabolite repression carbon hierarchy was done by Chonghui Yu, Chonghui Yu and Hiro Okano, two biologists, theoretical physicists, Robert Hermson, who is now at the Utrecht in the theoretical biology department, and 20 of the physics graduate students. Okay, so the motto of our lab, nothing in molecular biology makes sense except in the lab of physiology. Thank you.
Maybe let me come in from the protocol.
Sorry, it's a silly question. I know you're only student.
Student.
I was just wondering, do you have any insights on the enhancements of the growth rate when you have the two common sources?
Yeah, so we could say a lot about there's two, the growth rate addition formula, yeah, growth rate increases, okay. So actually, if you use two carbon sources, the growth rate increases, if it can be used together in a simple way, okay. And in the glucose glycerol system where there's the hierarchy, if you remove the hierarchy, growth rate increases.
And that didn't happen in all the two carbon sources.
So for some carbon source pairs, it's naturally just co-utilized and grows faster with two carbon source, right? The other group, there's a hierarchical usage. But of those group, if you remove this one interaction, this one system that we study in detail, okay, it grows faster. Not only that, growth on glycerol alone is so fast, it's faster than growth on glucose. Okay, so certainly when you talk about this type of a thing, growth rate is not a, it's thinking about something else. It's not about growth.
Do you know what is it? It's something else.
I hope to answer that question in 5 years.
I want to come back to this issue they run out of glucose, they then produce these acetates.
Yes. Yes.
And then they keep growing at the same rate. Well, first of all, why are they
same rate?
Produce, the rate of, if you do an exponential growth curve in say minimal glucose, it continues. Yeah. And then it sort of
But you're talking about really towards the later part of exponential.
We were going a little more than one division before. I mean,
fine.
Half the glucose should be gone. Why are they?
No. But you can so we and others have measured the glucose uptake and acetate. And so there's another subject I did not talk about. We'll spend another half hour talking about. So acetate is taken up, right? And then it's really gross on acetate.
Right.
Yeah. But that's kinky. Huh?
It's kinky. Why are they doing that? Why are they?
The why question is great. I mean, that's what I'm saying. We have to. So this is certainly a problem that we need to think in the context of ecology, because in the gut, in anaerobic conditions, all acid, it's floating, it's swimming into very very high concentration of acetate, right? And whatever we're doing here, we're not respecting these at all. So to understand this, we need to look in a more natural environment.
So when microbes are evolved in carbon-limited media, like one of the really common things they break is this cyclic AMP feedback loop. And so I'm wondering, how are they gaining a physiological advantage by eating? Do you think it's a physiological advantage that they're
gaining? Well, certainly, if you disrupt this loop, if you disrupt this, right, you're making more carbon uptake protein than you need as you go to a fast carbon source, and you're making not enough ribosomes. So it grows slower, right? If you get rid of it, certainly grows slower. I can reproduce this entire curve just by cranking cyclic AMP. So there is an optimal cyclic AMP level where the cell grows close to the wild type.
I guess I just have sort of philosophical comment on the end. In some real way, the molecular biology is very close to the genotype. Right, and the physiology.
Molecular biology is very close to genotype.
The molecular level things are very close to genotype, right?
And what do you mean, very close to genotype?
This is level of the analogies we're talking about. Right? The physiology is the phenotype, right? The
interaction. Physiology is the. You're making. Right, molecular is the genotype.
The physiology is the phenotype, but the organism that cares about as far as overall effects and what affects the environment and everything else.
Yeah.
Right? And by the time we're getting down to the molecular biology, where it goes much very close to the genome.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a big gap between the two, right?
Yeah.
And that's
well,
very close
I just
to the
got a grant to study that link. But there's a whole statistical, but you have to do thermodynamics first before you can do statistical mechanics, right? So how to bridge that?
Yes, but then we should move on to coffee because we have another talk scheduled for this morning. Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask? No, I was wondering about in the old studies when they looked at ribosome concentration,
as a function of growth rate. You have this kind of plateauing effect.
So
when you come down to them, there's no growth rates.
So
the linearity kind of disappears.
I'm just showing you this region where we studied, where everything is simple. So as you push down, like more complicated things happen.
Have you looked at that? We're
looking into that, but I don't need to talk about that. No, for the part that I think we understand.
Okay. Terry, how much longer are you going to be? Do you have around this afternoon?
Until dinner time.
So you're going to be around next week, but you'll be around today, so you can.
Okay. Thank you very much.